everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the one reality, the traces of the one reality that they see underlying them.
You betcha. And this is, were we calling this season two?
I think so.
All right, then. Welcome. This is neat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're starting up and should be, straight on till morning?
That's Peter Pan, right?
Oh, okay.
But yes.
For me, it's Star Trek.
Oh,
but I'm sure Star Trek got it from Peter Pan or somebody. I don't know. I don't know that they used exactly those words, but
first star on the right and straight on till morning.
Yeah, that's something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Well, today so we're gonna. Oops, sorry.
Episode 26.
This is episode number 26.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about Harry Potter. Yes. We wrote Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, but I think we're going to talk about all of them.
Yes, it's nothing like starting off with a bang, right? I couldn't choose small.
That's right. So, yeah.
We're talking about the books, by the way. Not,
yes, exactly.
I mean, although we can talk about the movies, this is the books.
That's right. So. That's right. Yeah, and Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. I have really great memories of this because we went as a family to the the midnight release of this down at the Borders bookstore, which doesn't exist anymore. Sniff, sniff.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, and boy, was it fun. You know, they threw a big party out in the front, and yeah, I don't remember. Well, actually, I'm turning around because I have a poster. It was July of 2007.
Wow.
We had a poster that we got at Borders there. So
nice fandom.
Yeah, so but yeah, I kept the poster, actually, didn't frame it, but I put it on, I don't know what you call that backing. Anyway, we kept the poster because it was so fun. We had such a good time, and it was cool just to go to a party where everybody was excited about a book.
Yeah.
And,
and it's funny because our family, our kids were just the right age that when the first book came out, or I heard about the first book, so maybe the second book had come out by then, I read to them every night. So I said, well, okay. So we got Harry Potter and started reading, and we all loved it. So then I grabbed the second book, read that immediately, and then we would have that wait for the other books to come out. And by the time maybe the fifth one came out, is that the first one where it starts to get really dark?
Yeah, it's the first one where they get big. Yeah, and
we may
have
read that one together, or we may have then just started passing them around between us and then talking about them. So we didn't have that let's go to the party thing, although the kids would do it with their friends for the openings, and they would also do it for the movies when they came out. And I saw the first two or three. I know I saw one and three, and I can't remember if I saw two. And three of those, three was definitely the superior one.
Yeah, that was my opinion, too.
And but my kids have gone on going to the movies. I mean, you know, even when the Deathly Hallows came out, the last one. And that's what made me pick up the books again.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. And I remember, so I read the first one out loud to my son, Chris. Gosh. So we must have started to pick them up when three was out, but four was not. I think that's kind of where we started. It was before the movies. And then, yeah, ever since then, we've just been picking them up one at a time. We didn't go to every release party, but that last one we did, and it was a great memory. And I recall thinking, how in the heck is J.K. Rowling going to pull this off? I mean, can you imagine having this many eyes on you?
Yeah.
And how, you know, incredibly nervous I would be, you know. It was just the pressure on her must have been tremendous.
And the book is spectacular.
The book is just fantastic. I couldn't. I was stunned by it. I thought it was excellent.
Well, and the thing that mystifies me is, and maybe it's because of the way we were reading them, because, you know, we read them and liked them and everything. And by the time we were reading them separately, they were starting to get very complicated. And I'd have to go back and start looking at the previous book to make sure I remembered everything. And so I remember really, really liking the last book, but it didn't hit me the way it did when I went through them again. And part of that, I think, is because I listened to them. Because when the last movie came out, it made me suddenly think, oh, you know what? They probably have these on audiobook, and I would like to read these again, but I think I'll listen. And I think I've mentioned on here before maybe that Jim Dale does the American versions, and he's so wonderful.
Yeah.
That I was just immediately hooked. So then I just got them from the library, and I listened to one right after the other. So I listened to all seven in a row, and the cumulative effect really hit me in a way that the other didn't. And
wow.
I don't know if it's maybe because of our podcast together or, you know, what changed. But by the time we got to the last one, I mean, I didn't remember most of book six, which I was stunned at. And I didn't remember most of book seven and maybe even part of book five. I mean, I would remember huge events, but even then I discovered I remembered some of them wrong. So I was in the state of getting to enjoy them again because the kids would start to talk about them. I'd go, I don't remember that. And they go, oh, okay. And so I was in this state of anticipation, and I could re-experience how well she crafted these stories each individually and then as an overarching cycle.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key things. You know, so often what happens nowadays is someone publishes a book and then they say, well, you know, that did so well, I'm going to go ahead and write a sequel. But she has stated over and over, and it seems clear to me, and I'm glad to hear you say what you said, because I did not read all seven books again. That it certainly appears that she knew what she was doing from book one. And, you know, so she had this seven story arc in mind when she started. And what a difference that makes in depth and cohesiveness and,
character development.
Yeah. And there are no books here that are throwaway books. You know, this is a great series.
Well, should I extremely briefly, for the person who's been living under a rock or who hasn't wanted to pick the books up, in which case I apologize for the living under a rock comment, picked them up. And I mean, hopefully if you haven't read these books, but you listen to this podcast, this will encourage you to pick them up, because one of the arguments about the books is always, should Christians read them? Which
yes.
And by the time we get done, but let me just really super briefly, tell the basic premise, I guess, and then we can go right into spoilers. Because so when the first book opens, and I don't think anybody realized at that time there were going to be seven. In this country, it was called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It's really clear to everybody around that something odd is going on, because all these very oddly dressed people are running up to normal people in the streets and hugging them and saying, Voldemort is dead and he shall not be named is gone. And nobody knows what's going on. And you see somebody drop a baby off on a doorstep after a brief kind of incomprehensible conversation with someone. And then the book leaps ahead 11 years. And what you find out is that there are two worlds. There's our world, and then there's the wizarding world of people who can do magic. They call the normal people muggles. And in that secondary world, you're born with the ability to do magic, or you're not. But once it's discovered, you're invited to go to the wizarding school, Hogwarts. And that's what happens to Harry, who is the baby who was dropped off on the doorstep. He starts to find out about the wizarding world, and it's a wonderful device because you also get pulled into that world and discover it as he does. And he goes off to school, and it turns into one of a more understandable story of, you know, he's making his friends, he has his enemies, you learn what Harry is like, you learn what different lessons there are to be learned, both of magic and of life. And at the same time, what he starts to discover through the series of books is that the great evil wizard who was killed, Voldemort, who had a stranglehold of terror on everybody, might not be dead. And maybe he's gunning for Harry because he tried to kill Harry when he was a baby.
Right.
That's the premise for the book. And it goes on from when he's 11 to, well, for 7 years, because they go to school for 7 years.
Yeah.
And
and the kids grow up during these books, too. They're not they're not the same in book one as they are in book seven, or vice versa.
Right. And the books also grow in complexity so that the first books are really good for like, what, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. But by the time you get to the fourth or fifth book, if the kid is not older like that, it starts to hit some really dark things that aren't appropriate for those younger kids. And by the time you get to the last book, you need to be older in order to grasp everything because awful things are happening. And I've often thought if I had older or younger kids, how would I parcel these out? Because, of course, you want the next book as soon as it comes out.
Yeah.
And in fact, my kids have talked about that with their friends.
Yeah, and that's interesting because Chris, you know, like I said, we read number one out loud, but from pretty much 4, 5, 6, and 7, he would read them first before I got to him.
Right.
Because he wanted to read them so bad. And there were times, I have a really clear memory of me sitting in the living room reading a book and him in a chair reading a book. And I can't recall, it was 5 or 6. But his eyes got really big and he looked at me and he said, "Oh my gosh." And then started reading again. And he was, you know, it was like he was a little upset, you know. It's a really, you know, like a flashbulb memory.
You know? Oh,
so then I was like, well, I wanted to say, well, what happened? But,
give
you know.
Give me the book. You don't need it.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are rough things that happen, especially in those later books.
Yeah. So I think we can go to spoilers now. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay.
Because because those books, the thing that impressed me, even on the first reading when I didn't remember a lot of it later, is that Rowling isn't afraid to deal with real matters of life and death, like having people die who you like, because that's how it works. And Harry is left racked with guilt, because sometimes he was the intended victim and somebody else died either just through circumstance, like Cedric Diggory, or because they sacrificed themselves.
Right. Yeah, and man, you feel for Harry Potter. I mean, it's several times in this book, you know, he feels to me, you know, there are times when I've got annoyed with him.
Yes.
But the reason was because of, you know, all the stuff that was happening to him, and I think it was a realistic portrayal of the character. Because, man, you know, for a teenager to go through all that, man, that's gonna affect your personality, say the very least. I mean, it was rough, yeah. But at the same time, he was an admirable character, in my opinion.
Well, and this kind of speaks to the fact that Rowling, she was so good. She fleshed everybody out by the end. I can only think only Mr. Dursley didn't really have any element that didn't add depth to him. You know, Mrs. Dursley, you discovered about her feelings about her sister, her true feelings, and why she was the way she was to Harry. Even their horrible son, who I can't remember his name.
Dudley.
How could I not? He was, you know, spoiled rotten, but even he had depths that, you know, when he comes forward and thanks Harry for saving his life. You know, despite what his parents would say. But the thing with Harry is, yes, on re-listening, I became so intensely annoyed with him sometimes. But it was because he's a teenager. And sometimes you become just darned annoyed at teenagers because they tend to be self-focused. And in his case, his self-focus was that he always should have done more. You know, it's that hero's thing of I should save everyone, and sometimes you can't, and sometimes you have to work with other people, and he has to learn those lessons too.
Right, yeah.
You know, which is
That's a really good point. That's a really good point, because, yeah, you know, teenagers that are not going through this stuff sometimes are difficult.
Right.
So, but yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so I thought that was, she did such a good job of, you know, it's obvious in some characters, like even the heroes of the book are not 100% heroic. you know, Dumbledore by the end. You don't want him to be weak.
Yeah, and again, him, you know, I found him frustrating too at times.
Yes.
There was almost an entire book there where he hardly spoke to Harry Potter. And he was doing so for a reason, but it's just like, come on, just tell him why. You know, why not just say something?
Slip him a note,
yeah,
man.
Exactly, yeah.
But what you find out is that's part of his weakness. He loves to keep secrets. He loves to manipulate everything himself. And although he's doing it for the best possible motives, that's a weakness. Because one of the things about this book, and I let me just stop right here and say, I picked this series because I could not believe the Christian themes that were just being slapped at you by the end. And yet at the same time, it was done so well that nobody goes around saying, it's such a Christian book.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you don't already know the symbolism and a lot of the other things, it's just a fantastic adventure. And so a lot of the themes that I saw in here, like, you know, the fact that Dumbledore will keep things to himself and not work with community, that's a Christian message.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's interesting. You sent me this article, and I'll make sure I link to it. It was actually on MTV. It was called J.K. Rowling Talks About Christian Imagery. And there's just a little quote here. She says, "To me, the religious parallels have always been obvious," she said. "But I never wanted to talk too openly about it because I thought it might show people who just wanted the story where we were going."
Right.
And I think that that's a really interesting statement from her. So she did have this stuff in mind, and it does show up all over. But she didn't want to make, you know, she didn't want to walk around talking about the imagery because somebody would probably guess, hey, how this is going to end.
Right. Well, yeah. And I don't know if you recall, well, of course you must, but by the end of the sixth book, there was a huge debate going out on, because in that book, Snape has killed Dumbledore. And everybody, is he evil or is he good? And I was like, okay, it's too obvious for him to be evil.
Yeah.
He has to have done this for some other reason that we don't know.
Right, and that's how I felt about it too when I was reading it. It was like, you know, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, obvious. But isn't it interesting, you know, one of the things that I caught is the Ministry of Magic is constantly denying the existence of Voldemort. And they're saying, you know, he's not back. You know, what are you talking about? He's not back. You know, even though that things are obvious.
Yeah.
And that's a parallel to our world right now. Where, you know, a lot of people say evil doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. What is, you know, that's not evil over there. That's, you know, or whatever, you know what I'm saying? You know, so.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're Christian, sorry to any non-Christians listening, but it's just that this is pretty clear. We're always under attack from evil.
Yeah.
Capital E. In subtle ways.
In subtle ways,
one of the most
subtle,
they always say these days, is that people think it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I read something recently, and this is just a slight side trip, but I thought it was interesting where they said, the fact that you try to attribute everything that happens, even if it's bad, like, oh, you had bad parents, you were treated, you were bullied, you were this, you were that, and these are all the excuses that are made for someone. That's like, that's taking away your free will. That's saying you never could choose. You are always just at the whimsy of outside forces, and you had no determination of your own, even to somebody who's ultimately evil. And I was like, wow, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
And this is made, this is a point that's made very clear when you look at the fact that Voldemort and Harry really parallel each other in their lives.
Yeah, and they sure do. And Harry worries about it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, from the very first sorting hat, you know, before he really knows what's going on, he's worried that he's evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when the hat wants maybe to put him in...
Slytherin.
Slytherin, thank you. I was like, how could I not remember that? Because he could go either way.
Right.
And isn't it clever, and this goes back to what you were saying about the wisdom of having the story planned out to the seven books, those hints of what's going on are in the very first book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he could be either one. Well, by the end book, you find out it's because he and Voldemort are linked to each other intimately through their souls.
Right, right.
And so he's good. That's how he understands Parseltongue in the third book, I think it is, or second book. I can't remember. And all these subsequent ones. And things like, even things, little things like, let's see, I wrote it down here. Oh, yeah. Neville. Mm. He never seems like he belongs in Gryffindor because he's not brave. But he wins the House Cup when Dumbledore gives him 50 points because he stands up to his friends when he thinks they're wrong.
Right, right. That was neat.
Yeah. And that's the seed of what you see later that is so dramatic. You just want to stand up and cheer yourself when everybody thinks that Harry is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason to stand up to Voldemort. He's all powerful. And here's little Neville Longbottom going, no, I won't.
Yeah.
Dumbledore's army. You know, he's us.
Right.
He's what we should be. He's not going to give in. He knows what's true. He's going to do what he's supposed to do.
Yeah.
He's who we should be. Yeah.
Fantastic. So well done. So well done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've recently been talking to a reading group. We're actually going to read The Hunger Games.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things, I was trying to present, well, a couple of things. One was, you know, how a book is, well, first of all, what does a good book mean? You know,
mm-hmm.
it means different things to different people, but C.S. Lewis, and I looked this up, a book I read a long time ago was called An Experiment in Criticism by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, I've heard that's good.
Yeah, and he tried to define what a good book is. And, you know, it means different things to different people. But he says, you know, a good book is a book which is read in one way, and a bad book is one which is read in another. Which, you know, boy, that's, you know, pretty wide open.
Yeah.
But so, you know, some of the things, you know, for good books, you know, you read things more than once.
Mm-hmm.
You look for chances to read it. You can experience momentously, or it can change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to talk about it. Scenes and characters as part of their iconography.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying that right?
Iconography,
right.
Okay.
Through which they sum up their own experience. So the reader is summing up their own experience through the book. And and the bad books basically don't do those things. That was kind of his point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you look at Harry Potter, it's definitely got all that stuff. You know, when you read it again, it's got this depth that a lot of books just don't have. And, you know, the other thing that I was talking to the kids about was how a book can be inspired by other works.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a list, and again, I'll put the link out there, but there's a whole list of things that influenced Harry Potter. You know, she said, mm-hmm. I found an interview in which she said, well, she got the idea while she was riding on a train. And it just, you know, somehow dropped in her lap, she said, about a boy who didn't know he was a wizard, you know, headed off to wizard school. You know,
right.
So there was the germ of the idea. But the story itself is influenced by a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that way it becomes part of a bigger conversation. And I think that's part of what makes a book really good, too. It's hard to define what you think is a good book.
Or
what a good book should have in it. But having it be part of a larger conversation, I think, is an element that I personally believe defines a good book.
And that's a good way to put it, because those are the underlying themes that people relate to, whether accepting or rejecting.
Mm-hmm.
And how the characters relate. Because I would say the other thing, the larger conversation is, that's a great way to put it. Because what we're talking about is, this relates to the larger conversation of Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an example of how you live. So many great things in this series. But the other thing is characters that are really real.
Mm-hmm.
They show human nature.
Yeah.
you know, because that's otherwise you can't relate to them, and you don't have to have a character that you deliberately relate to. But I'm trying to think of books that I love where, even though the they may be old or the subject matter may be a bit dated, like, say, Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. which is what sprang to mind. But the characters, you know, people like that. You recognize that, whether it's, you know, Macbeth and his pushy wife who's trying to fulfill a prophecy, which she mentioned in terms of Voldemort, mm-hmm. influencing Voldemort, or, you know, Scarlet and Gone with the Wind, who's just so selfish that all she can see is what she wants, or even Melanie in Gone with the Wind. I don't know if you've read it, but most people have seen the movie, I guess. Yeah. Well, someday we will, my friend. Someday we will. But anyway, you know, who's the goody-goody who you admire, but you can understand why Scarlet kind of despises her also, because she doesn't understand that gentle, good nature, who's always going to be the iconic person who does the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes a good book also.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because it's talking about humans, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so, this book definitely has that too.
Yeah, it has both those things.
Without question.
Well, and we got pulled away from, I was saying something about community, but I was realizing that, you know, you expect that from a book about, you know, three great friends working together to solve a problem. But what you don't expect is it's going to be carried on over the seven books. And so that at the end, it's a clear matter of people having to join together to fight evil, to not say that it doesn't exist,
mm-hmm.
and to not knuckle under.
Right.
You know, it doesn't always come down to an actual fight the way it does in this book, but that we support each other. That's important. You can't go it alone.
Yeah, right.
And that's very Christian.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And then, of course, the ending also just, you know, huge. You know, and it's, I marvel a little bit, you know, because at the beginning, it's really love is what saved Harry Potter. At the beginning, Voldemort was not out to get Harry Potter, right?
Right.
He was out to get his parents. But Harry Potter survived because of what his mom did.
Yes.
Right? And it was love.
She sacrificed herself to save her son.
Exactly.
And so Voldemort couldn't kill him.
Exactly right. And then the ending is the bookend on the other end.
And that's the thing where I was just like, we have to talk about this.
Yeah, for certain, for certain. That was a sacrifice of, you know, huge order. You know, Harry Potter had no idea what was going to happen.
It was a willing sacrifice. That was the important thing. It was a active sacrifice. He didn't just wait as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, because the parallels to Christ, he's like such a Christ figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so the parallels to Christ are so blindingly obvious if you're thinking that way. If you're not, it's just the most amazing story ever.
Mm-hmm.
Because once he finds out that he has got to willingly go and sacrifice himself, he always knew it was going to be him or Voldemort. And if one, then later on he finds out, oh, great, when he dies, I die, because they're tied together.
Mm-hmm.
Then when he finds out he has to willingly go and do it, that walk that he takes through the woods where he's kind of detached and he can't let himself care or talk to anybody too much because he loves his friends and being alive, of course, so much that he knows if he does, he will not be able to carry it out. I was talking to Rose, and she said that made her think of the Garden of Gethsemane from the first time she read it. And I said, you know what? To me, now that once you introduced that idea, it was actually more like his passion, the suffering that he went through, that Christ went through in order to give himself up willingly in every way. That was Harry having to walk through and stop and go, Neville, if I don't make it back, you've got to kill Nagini. You know, not stopping to talk to Ginny, not doing all these things, having his parents there to offer him support. You know, that's the like the angels supporting him on the way. But he has to go and do it.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful stuff.
I hadn't thought of that until Rose said it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it until you said it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. And then, I mean, I was practically crying when I read it anyway. And now just thinking about the fact that he's, you know, for Christ, they say he's priest and victim. And Harry Potter kind of really illustrates that. He's because of the action. A victim waits for you to do it. The priest is offering the sacrifice up.
Yeah, and he was both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then when he dies and he finds himself in that misty place with Dumbledore, who finishes putting in all the missing pieces of the puzzle, and you see Voldemort's soul nearby. And Harry keeps wanting to try to help him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's never clearly identified, but everybody knows who it is, the pathetic creature mewling, you know, for help. So that even at the end, when Harry comes back and he knows it's not going to go well for Voldemort, he offers him a last chance, which is stunning in itself.
Yeah, it sure is. Like,
he's like, this is going to happen one way or the other, but you've got one chance. I've seen what's going to happen to you. Be remorseful.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Voldemort is so proud. He would never even, he's like, what? No way.
Yeah. Wow. And you say you have not seen the last movies.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Mm-mm. Why?
No, I was just curious because they really did it well.
Did they?
Yeah.
I'll have to watch the last one then.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought they did a fantastic job. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can't put in the movie, you know, and the depth of that walk, you know, you're not going to convey that in a movie very easily.
Right.
But I didn't, you know, think of that until you said it. So now I want to read it all again.
Oh.
but you can't convey that in a movie very easily, like I said. But all those other elements that you said are in there.
Well, and that's the thing that, because when Rose and I were talking, because Rose, since she'd already thought about it, we started really kind of talking together. And she goes, well, in that way, Harry's got his disciples, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ron is like Peter.
Yeah.
He doubts, but mm-hmm. he returns. Neville is like John, the beloved disciple. He's always there. You don't even know John's name, really. We don't even know that that's really the beloved disciple. It's just assumed. He's so humble, he never identifies himself. He's the one who looks into the empty tomb, waits for Peter to go first, because Peter's the leader, but he looks and believes even though he doesn't understand.
Huh.
That's like Neville.
Yeah,
he doesn't understand, but he believes and he obeys.
Right.
And I don't know if these are just types that Rowling put in there or if she was thinking about it this deliberately, but as many parallels as I see, I don't think I'm reading myself into here. I think she probably was thinking about a lot of that when she was going along because, and for a Catholic, that place where he's talking to Dumbledore,
mm-hmm.
you know, Dumbledore's like, I can't go on. I have a feeling if you call the train, you could go on. Because that's purgatory.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then the beauty of, and this quote is seen everywhere, the thing where he says, you know, well, but isn't this all in our heads? And Dumbledore goes, yeah, but what makes you think that's not real?
Mm-hmm.
Of course it's real.
Yeah.
And even to later, I'm sorry to keep going.
I've
just had this
problem
for so long. But
this
even
is
to
good.
The point where... since I was listening, I was just going, oh my gosh, it's in the blood. His blood protected everyone. Voldemort can't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you know, Christ's blood sacrificed for us. And then when he's under the invisibility cloak fighting, nobody knows he's there, but he's striking blows on their behalf. They don't recognize it. They don't even, can't even tell in the fury of the battle what he's exactly doing. They just know someone trips or someone does whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there helping the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, how much more obvious could this be?
Yeah, really stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there that I never thought of. Yeah, now I can't wait to read it again.
Well, after I listened to the seventh book, I went back and listened to the last 3 hours again because mm-hmm. I was just knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was the listening that made it... emphasized for me because I had to go slow. I couldn't speed through it the way I usually would. So there is an advantage to that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And Jim Dale is excellent. Did you? Yes. You must have liked him if you listened to all seven. So.
Oh my gosh! Yes. Well, and, especially when I realized, oh my gosh, it's the Pushing Daisies narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if people never are not Pushing Daisies. Yeah, that's it, right?
Boy, I haven't seen Pushing Daisies, so.
Oh, you haven't?
I have not.
Okay, I put that down in like letters in your list. So inventive, right. So clever, uh-huh. So everything. And they have a narrator,
uh-huh.
And he's the narrator.
Oh, cool.
Rose kept saying, I don't think I could listen to these because I would always just see Pushing Daisies. And I was like, believe me, you mm-hmm. don't even think about that after a little while.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. Yeah, I was blown away by his narration. And most of these books I listened to and never read.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So even that one I described of Chris, I remember we must have bought the audio too.
Okay.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the way we did all those books after that fourth one.
Okay.
But I loved the audio. I thought Jim Dale was just stunning.
I've heard people say that Stephen Fry is equally good. He did the UK version.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, and that was an annoyance to me, is why have a UK version and a American version? That was a little annoying to me. And I got the first Stephen Fry narrated.
Was it good?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was great.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to find out, okay, well, what's the difference? And, you know, there were things like... you know, the candy that Dumbledore likes is sherbet lemon,
yeah.
Instead of whatever it was in the American version.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, you know, how cool is that? You know, that's kind of a neat touch. It enhances the book. Why do they think they need to change it?
I mean, kids for centuries have been reading each other's books and learning about their culture through it. They missed a big chance, I think, just for those little touches of us to understand each other better, for one thing,
just,
even if it's just candy.
Annoyance. I don't know who made that decision, but, you know, surely we have to remove this. Kids are not going to know what that is.
And marketers.
I'm just like, oh.
Who are themselves pretty narrow-minded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I wanted to say, you know, because you see so clearly, it's interesting, Voldemort and Harry... they do have those parallel lives. They're both orphans. Mm-hmm. They're both picked on. They're both, you know, all these things. And Voldemort chooses to go the way of pride. He discovers early that he can do magic, and he just uses it to be evil to people.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry, always when he's given a chance, he always chooses the kinder way. Even at the end with Voldemort does a killing curse to him. Harry does Expelliarmus, which would be to jerk the wand out of Voldemort's hand, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's just to take the power away from him.
Right, right.
It's not to kill him.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, how much of that is inherent in your personality versus the choices you make? Because from the very first book, over and over and over, there are different quotes where Rowling is making the point, it's the choices you make that make you different. Let's see. I had one marked, but let's see if I can. It's not like it's hugely profound. It's just in the Chamber of Secrets, so it's the second book, I guess. Voldemort tells Harry, it is our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are, far more than our abilities. And then later on, he makes the same point about, he says, in the Order of the Phoenix, he says, the world isn't split into good people and Death Eaters. We've all got both light and dark inside of us. What matters is the part we choose to act on. That's who we are.
Hmm. Yeah, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then the points made early on from, is that the one where Voldemort, it's the only time you see Voldemort and Dumbledore together is, yeah, the Order of the Phoenix, mm-hmm. and they're fighting. And Voldemort says, there's nothing worse than death. And Voldemort's like, see, you're really wrong about that. Your failure to understand that there are things much worse than death has always been your greatest weakness. So he won't take instruction from anyone. He, even when he's a kid and, you know, you see Dumbledore's memories of him being brought to the school,
mm-hmm.
he's always very proud.
Yeah.
And he won't trust community or friends. He won't learn anything from anyone else unless he thinks he can just use it for himself.
Yeah, right.
He's Lucifer, essentially. Mm-hmm. The morning star who had so yeah, much, that, you know, that was ties closest into, to God.
That ties into the whole thing I mentioned earlier where people just kept denying his existence. You know,
right.
He doesn't exist.
Or they'd call him he who must not be named. Is that it?
Yeah.
And they wouldn't say his name. So.
And Harry was never afraid to say his name.
Right. Because Dumbledore always said, always call things what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And see that, again, that's a very straightforward message of, you know, see things for what they are. See reality for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's kind of interesting because if you know all this stuff, it's hard to see how people couldn't see the Christian symbolism. Well, especially by the last book. That was the thing where I was like, who are all these Christians who are going, no, you can't read it because there's magic in it.
Yeah. And, you know, apart from it being just an excellent story, you
right.
know, and you can see that the depth in it that you see, but, you know, it can be taken as just an excellent story without looking into this depth.
Yeah.
But why do you think that folks were having a problem with it?
I think people are superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, to somebody, I've never understood that whole concept of, like, I have a sister-in-law who wouldn't let her kids read Harry Potter because it had magic in it. And she's, you know, a non-denominational Protestant, really strong Christian. I really admire her faith. But I was like, well, so you're saying these words can hurt you? I mean, isn't it, are you talking, saying that free will is not there? Are you saying that Christ is not stronger than death or Satan? And I'm not saying go around tempting yourself, but to think that reading about kids doing magic in a book is going to be an evil influence on you, I don't know. I just think that's like saying God doesn't have any power and you don't either.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah, I can't imagine this book being viewed negatively, you know, and even before I really understood, you know, the imagery
right.
that we're talking about here,
right.
which
early on, this is when the first book came out.
Early on, I always thought it was good. I mean, it was, I never felt like, oh, I don't think my son should be reading that. I was happy that he was reading that.
Yeah.
And,
it was a great story.
Yeah. And Harry Potter has really become, like I mentioned, you know, I was talking to this youth group. When I go in there and I say, Harry Potter, book 3, everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Right.
They all know. This is like the standard where everybody comes from now.
Right.
It is the one thing that everybody's read.
Well, and the other thing is do people who think denying the book to their kids, do they think their kids are not going to come across them? I mean, because they're forgetting what it's like to be a kid.
Yeah, you can say that about a lot of stuff. You know, you can you can deny your kids access to everything, or you can help them have access to everything.
I don't mean everything.
You can help them properly understand. I don't mean you open the door wide open and let them, you know, explore the internet, you know, and all that stuff. I'm just saying that you. You be there with them as they're going through stuff, you know, or as they experience this stuff. So it was a great experience to read these books with the kids.
And Yeah.
It's so, I mean,
our shared experience as parents with our kids.
Yeah. And it's exactly what it is, a shared experience. And shared experiences are wonderful. I mean, that's what you want.
Well, and I also didn't understand. Every parent I ever talked to who did that, which was just two or three really, they had not read the books themselves.
Yeah.
They were going on what they'd heard. And I may have talked about this before on the podcast, I can't remember. At one point, Rose was in some advanced reading group, and the teacher, she was in the fourth grade. So this was a young, idealistic teacher, and they were reading at such an advanced level that she was letting them choose from high school reading lists. So they chose Ender's Game, which from the basic description sounds quite exciting, and it is. And I was like, wait a minute. I know this was written for adults, actually. And so I was reading it ahead of Rose. I didn't really want to read the book. I mean, that's fine. It wasn't a book I cared about. But I always stayed a few chapters ahead of her because I wanted to know what she was being exposed to. And there is such extreme cruelty and other things being shown in that book, and for a reason, that before Rose got to it, I took the book away and I called the teacher and started protesting. And the teacher was like, well, they picked it. And I was like, no, 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 no. And I'm thinking, well, if I could do that with Ender's Game, who wouldn't care enough about their kid to pick up Harry Potter and read it? That's not that hard. Then you know, yes or no. At least then you can say, I have read this book, and I'm going to tell you this. And when you're this age, I'll let you read it. Because when Rose was in high school, I gave it to her. Because she was upset. Yeah, she was upset.
Now it's interesting also that you felt that way about Ender's Game. It's similar to Harry Potter in a way, too.
Well, but think about the older brother. And
yeah,
things he do and how they were described. I didn't want a fourth grader reading that. Elle's a fourth grader.
Yeah, yeah.
Eight,
right,
nine.
Right, yep.
So that was when I was like, you know, I don't think these are good images to expose you to right now. When you're older, okay. So when she was in high school, like I say, she was a freshman. I got down the book, and both of us had forgotten about it. Actually, I just put it on a bookshelf and said, I'll keep it. When you're older, you can have it. And she's like, hey, what about that? And I'm like, oh, here. You know.
Yeah.
And there are movies that I wouldn't let them watch when they were little, although they'd be exposed to a lot of stuff at friends' houses. But there are a lot of movies that, you know, but when they were older in high school and graduating and I'd walk by and they're watching American Gigolo, well, they could go watch anything, anywhere they want. I can't stop them. What I have to do is trust that I've raised them in such a way they have good judgment.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I agree.
So.
Yeah.
But, and that, you know, and there are people who like to quote the Pope in saying that he spoke out against Harry Potter. But I remember when that happened, and you may also, what he was responding to. I didn't go and look this up, but I have a clear memory. Somebody wrote him a letter describing the books from their point of view. And he responded saying, if what you say is actually the case, then these things are not good. But
yeah,
he had not read them.
I'm gonna have to look that up, and I'll put a link in there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll have to look on my blog also and see if I've got that saved anywhere, because people started then, they immediately picked it up and Harry Potter, hated by the Pope. And I was like, no, you forgot the qualifier. You know?
Right.
So if we can't find it, I'm going to be quite upset because I know it's there. But you get people like, even within the Catholic community, there's John Granger, who's championed the books from the beginning, written books about the symbolism and what they mean. And then there's Michael O'Brien, who's written, I think, more than one book talking about how awful the books are and they're not Christian and they return to paganism because the symbols are used wrongly. And I'm like, I don't think the symbols are used wrongly.
Yeah, and I wonder, I guess I just don't understand. You know, I read what you sent me. There was a link to a page that you sent me, and it had kind of a lengthy quote in there. And I read that, and it seemed to me that if what he's complaining about is true, we would end up with some kind of a, you know, Ray Bradbury, you know, nothing but, what was the story where there was,
I'm,
you know,
thinking it was the same story, was it?
Yeah, it was nothing but reality, not reality. Well, realism was the only possible movie you could ever go see. He eliminated everything else.
Yeah, it was set on Mars, although I don't think it was ever collected in the Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, was it called Usher 2, maybe?
Or something like that.
And, you know, definitely there were elements of it in Fahrenheit 451, too, because of, you know, all the book banning. And,
right.
But it just seemed that, you know, from the quote that I read, so I know I'm making a big leap here. It seems he's poo-pooing all of fiction. He's saying, you know, hey, if you're... You know, because people have these symbols. If you were raised Christian, especially, you've got this stuff inside you. And when you write something, the chances of something coming out, whether on purpose or not, that could be linked to a Christian symbolism is, you know, pretty high. So
definitely.
So, I guess that my point's made. I'm just saying that it seems to be saying that, hey, all of fiction is just not acceptable.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah, I just don't understand that point of view.
Yeah, I'd hate to see him talking about something like In Bruges.
Mm.
One of my favorite movies where you would never expect to see a very positive underlying message because it's so violent.
Yeah.
But, well, and think about the fact that, I mean, in case we didn't get it, on the tombstones of Harry's parents when we finally see him, the two quotes are from Scripture.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and she even said that, hey, this is really the, you know, they kind of, those two quotes
are
what this book is about.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And she herself, think about what she's saying about souls. And that's kind of the first paragraph of this article at MTV is where she's like, this book is about souls. How do you keep them whole? And what evil is required to split them in two?
Mm-hmm.
And Voldemort actually splits his soul into seven.
Right.
He thinks six, but seven.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just like, oh, he's just shaving away little bits of himself. No wonder he's less and less human as you get backstory on him.
Mm-hmm.
And then which book was it? It must have been the same one where the Order of the Phoenix, where they're in the Ministry of Magic. And there's that veil that Luna tells him later. Well, couldn't you hear those whispers? Those were the people we love who've died. They were talking to us from the other side.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's all through it.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first book starts with the premise that his mother's sacrifice saved him. The love that she had is in his blood. I mean, you can't get much more straightforward than that. And it's not that it came off as Christian, because it wasn't until the last book that any of that was confirmed. I remember people debating, you know, is it Christian, is it not Christian, till the very last book came out.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of how amazed I was by it, because,
right.
I mean, it's just fantastic. So well done by the author. Yeah.
And I would like to tell, have I told the story on the podcast before about Hannah's friend and how she was affected by this book?
Boy, I don't recall that. I don't recall
okay.
that.
Let me just, the thing I wanted to say is, of course, if somebody's listened this long, they've probably already read the books because we've spoiled everything pretty much. But the thing is that you don't have to care about a Christian message to recognize these books as being great. And one of Hannah's friends, who's from a fairly dysfunctional family and who rejects faith altogether because of that, which is too complicated to go into. But anyway, she loves these books. And one of her problems is she was very badly treated by a certain family member. So in that way, she understands that, you know, she thinks of that person in a sense, she would probably never say it, like being like Snape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really have a hard time loving him.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah remembers talking to her about the last book after it came out and saying, yeah, but see, you can see there's good in him, even though he does act awful. And even though we still do not like him and what he does, he has good at his core too. There's a good part of him. And this friend absolutely denied it, could not see it at all. Mm-hmm. Well, time goes by. The friend grows up. The friend moves away from family. She starts to become her own person. She receives affirmation and support from all these people. She's starting to really blossom, which is great to watch.
Mm-hmm.
They go to see the last movie together, and they all dress up, and they do everything. They're there for the midnight showing. They come out, and the friend is like, I love how you could see the good in Snape, despite he's evil. And Hannah's like, oh, my gosh. It's like a visual measure of her growth as a person in life and love.
Wow.
She said she wanted to stop and cry right there, but she couldn't because the friend was like, she goes, but I thought you, no, I never thought that. She didn't remember it at all.
How about that?
I know.
Yeah.
It was really amazing.
Wow, that is, yeah.
So.
Wow,
yeah,
story just has this power, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah,
not just
a
story,
it?
But just story.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it tells the truth.
Right.
It doesn't have to be
it
literal.
It tells the truth in a way that it can't be told otherwise.
Right.
It simply can't be said. I mean, I can say, well, Harry Potter is going to die to save everybody. He's going to sacrifice himself. Well, that sentence has no, even though it's true and it conveys a truth about the world, there's nothing in that that is helpful, right?
Right.
But the story is what moves you.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Well, and she takes you into it in such a way, you know, that you really are walking that walk with Harry. Somehow she gave me this, I don't know. She really kind of took me into it and really kind of helped me think about all that, the sacrifice that Christ made from his human side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, outside of the, you look at it and go, oh, the awful torture, but also the determination to obey because he loves everybody so much. It's hard to imagine that when you just hear those sentences, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's kind of part of why we go through Lent, to help us see that. But it somehow it just really carried me into understanding it in such a positive way, as opposed to the, oh, I'm so sorry you did that, to a, oh, thank you for loving me that much thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Sure do. Well, yeah, highly recommended. You know, yeah, like Julie said, if you haven't got this far, or if you've listened this far, you've probably read the books. But if you haven't, mm-hmm. man, what an experience! You know, I recommend the audio.
Oh yeah, and you'll get a lot from the regular reading the books.
Oh sure,
that's a different kind of an experience. And
mm-hmm.
but somehow that really just pulled me into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I know the last thing I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people didn't like the epilogue.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Because it just shows Harry married to Ginny. They have their family. They're sending them off to Hogwarts. You see Ron and Hermione, and you hear that Neville's gone on and become a teacher of botany or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And funny, like Rose said, she either didn't want to know anything or she wanted to know more. She found it unsatisfactory. Other people thought it was a very boring ending.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I loved was, I read this on Darwin Catholic's blog when it came out, and I had to agree. They said, this is the proper thing that Harry wanted. He wanted a family to mm-hmm. love him, and then he could love.
Yeah.
Isn't this what every man and woman wants? Isn't this what every boy and girl wants?
Mm.
To be part of a loving family like that. He got the ultimate human reward.
Wow. Yeah. Bravo.
Yes, thank you, Darwin Catholic. I think it was Mrs.
Yes,
Darwin.
Mrs. Darwin Catholic.
Yes, but that awesome. Really helped me, because people kept, even when the movie came out, people kept going, yeah, I wish that ending was different. And I was like, no, you don't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the ultimate goal.
Yeah, that is powerful, you know, to think about it that way. You know, and I felt that she was closing the door on the series. I didn't think of any further purpose, but mm-hmm. I was thinking that she was saying, yes, I'm done with this, and I'm not going to be writing any more of these.
Right. Harry's, you know, can now go to a private life.
Exactly. We're not going to see, you know, Harry and his son or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but that's what I felt that she was doing with the epilogue. But
I read that and I went, mm-hmm. oh, beautiful way to see that fitting end for it.
Yeah. And it was fitting. That's great.
Yeah, they all get their reward of, you know, the thing they love the most, the family, the work that's so satisfying, like to Neville.
Yeah.
The one thing he was really obviously meant to do.
Yeah.
Because it came naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, one of these days, I'm definitely going to experience these like you did and just read them all back to back. Someday when I've got time to read, what do you think it is? 7,000 pages or something?
Well, I listened to all of them.
Yes.
So that was different, because what I did is I just quit listening to anything else. And I just, because I couldn't help it. Once I listened to the first book, I was addicted.
Uh huh.
So I think if you just find time to start the first one, you're good. It will just drag you in.
You bet. I love it. Well, thanks for picking these. I really love talking about them. I just love it.
I was so glad that you wanted to talk about them, because, like I say, I got done with at the end, and I had to listen to the end again. I was just bursting with excitement over them. So
cool.
If Fantastic. You've read them before, try them back to back.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to anybody who's listening.
Right.
Just because it's a triumphant story, and the beauty is that each story is self-contained, but they make such a wonderful cumulative story.
Mm.
You know, because there's a lot of stuff that she says that we don't, you didn't even get to, like, you know, the power of kindness, respect for human work, like when he's digging Dobby's grave, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. And
power of hope.
Right. Yes, that too. One of the things that I know that J.K. Rowling is doing is there's a site called Pottermore. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, I've heard of it, but I haven't gone there.
Yeah, it's in beta right now, and I'm looking at it right now. But she was going to be putting some writing out there. It seemed like some of the backstory material that she wrote in preparing to write the books and stuff, she was going to kind of shape up a little bit and put on the site. They were going to sell some ebooks on there, and it seems to be... I don't know what else is going to be on there, but there, it seems like it's going to be pretty neat. So that's Pottermore.com.
So she really couldn't shut that door.
Oh, well, it's always going to be open, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think she's adding material to the thing. I think it's just like
the saga.
A little bit backstory. And,
well, and I don't think we need any more, really.
Yeah, we really don't. And that's one of the things that's admirable so far.
Yeah.
You know, it's admirable so far to see that, you know, here she's... She's built this incredible thing, and she's not going to add to it until it's no good anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, it seems to happen with everything else, right? You know, how many Star Trek books are there?
I know.
Just,
well, you mentioned The Hunger Games, and I think that was designed to be one book originally, and the publishers went, no, we want three.
Yeah, and it sure seemed that way to me. I've read all three, and it seemed like the first one is standalone, and then... You know, like so often happens, they say, well, this would be great as a trilogy. So then she thinks up the next two. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of tell that the next two kind of go together. But the first one's standalone.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and that movie's coming out of it. So.
Yeah, and it is. It's coming out in March. It looks like it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this group that I'm doing, it's going to be fun because we're going to read the book and then we're going to all go see the movie. I've got 20 kids, so it should be a hoot. Take
How
a bus
old are
down
the
there.
Kids?
They're middle school, so 11, 12, 13.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, should be fun. Should be a hoot. Well, all right. Did you have something extra this week?
I do.
Excellent.
This has nothing to do with Christian faith. By the way, I've been listening to the Joe Ledger books, which are by Jonathan Mayberry.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of different stories going, evidently. He's got like a zombie apocalypse type universe, and he's got... But these are interesting to me because they're those hardcore thriller sorts, which are, you know, they're not the most complicated kind of books, but I can't help it. I like them. And... The hero is Joe Ledger, who's been recruited from being a cop to being a, you know, super secret American military type investigative group who goes around solving the real high level terror threats. And it's funny because they all have like these two components. In one sense, they're like James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. They've got the supervillain. They have the huge... we're going to wipe out the world through this bioengineered disease, which happens to make people just like zombies. So, yeah, the first book he's fighting zombies, that's called Patient Zero. The second book is called The Dragon Factory. So that's manipulating genetics to make all kinds of mythical type of creatures, which is kind of turns out to be a side story. I'm finishing The King of Plagues, which it deals with the 10 plagues visited on Egypt.
Oh, wow.
When Moses was, and it's, so it always winds up being an actual terrorist group who is using current stuff, supposedly, to make this happen, but they're always linking it with something mythical. The next one comes out in March or April, and it's called The Assassin, and I think it's a ninja-ish thing. So, because there's a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek awareness, they're fun. And, you know, Joe Ledger's a smart ass. I always like that.
Awesome. Oh, that's great. So, that's great.
Yeah. And there's a certain amount of heavy-handed talk about there is actual evil, capital E. Mm-hmm. So that's satisfying also.
Oh, cool.
Very fun. I highly recommend those.
All right. Well, cool.
And you?
And me. Well, I've been spending a lot of time lately reading a book called Jerusalem, a biography.
Nearly finished.
And man, it's, I love it.
Oh, really?
Yes, I really do. I've, I've been watching documentaries, you know, that I can find on Netflix mm-hmm. and stuff, and just mm-hmm. kind of immersing myself into this history of Jerusalem. And boy, it's fascinating stuff.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, yeah.
I got it, and it wasn't my kind of book, obviously. Uh-huh. So.
Yeah. You know, the author is Jewish, uh-huh. so there are some things in there like, you know, in the period when Jesus was around, you know, he says, well, you know, Jesus had these brothers, and, you know, most scholars believe that his body was removed from the tomb by somebody, you know, that yeah. kind of thing. And so, you know, he's not a Christian is what I'm saying.
Yeah, he'd do an eye roll and move on.
Exactly. But he's got, you know, the footnotes are fascinating too, you know, uh-huh. just throughout and you know, what a story that is of that uh-huh. city. So I'm almost done with it. I'm about in the last quarter of it now. So we're getting pretty close to modern times. And the book, in the introduction, he said the book was going to end at right around 1945.
Okay.
Because he felt like, you know, to go past that, he said he'd need to update it constantly. So he's going to say, okay, the end of this story is going to be the okay. creation of the Israeli state. So,
That's admirable, because he also kind of avoids that thing of looking at history when you're way too close to understand the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then yeah. you're going to write a review of that for Happy Catholic, right?
I definitely am. You
Excellent.
Betcha. Excellent. Yeah. But I've really enjoyed it, you know. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, I've got another documentary I'm going to watch that just came in the other day on DVD from Netflix. So, but it's neat. It's neat to be reading the book and then throw in a documentary, and you're like, oh, yeah. And they can, you know, what the Wailing Wall is, and, mm-hmm. you know, the Dome of the Rock, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and, you know, how old they are and what they've yeah. been through. Just amazing. Yeah.
Just reinforces all of that.
Yeah, reinforces all that to watch a documentary and see the places and mm-hmm. say, oh, yeah, that's what he was talking about. So.
Yeah. So have you ever been interested in going to the Holy Land?
Oh, I would love it. I would love
really?
It.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I would. Yeah. It's not, I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of taking my kids there until they're adults, just because yes. I'm afraid, you know, yeah. is that valid or not? I don't know, but that's how I feel. Mm-hmm. But you know, when they're adults, I would love for us all to go.
Oh, that's interesting. I've yeah. never been interested in going there. So mm-hmm. I was just curious if this had either reinforced or fueled any desire for it.
Oh, yeah, it reinforced. I've always wanted to go. Just never okay. have taken the time to do it. But, like, again, you know, part of it is because, you know, with the family, mm-hmm. I'm just not comfortable with going.
Well, with kids, yeah, mm-hmm. with young kids, it's with grown kids, that's different. For me, mm-hmm. Rome now.
Yeah, that would hit real while I was over
shot,
there, too.
But not... I'm just
yeah, my priest, as a matter of fact, he is going to Who Jerusalem. Is? My priest, Father
yeah.
Rob. Hello, Father Rob, if you're listening, is he's going to Jerusalem for Holy Week.
Okay.
And he's got I don't know, some kind of a deal that they've made where they're going to get to go to specific places during Holy Week, and yeah, he's very yeah. excited. So. That should be
well,
neat.
We have a deacon who got given a gift of like 2 weeks in the Holy Land, some tour several years ago. And he loved it so much that he came back, and every couple of years now, he'll take a group of pilgrims from our church with him.
Oh, so that would be fun.
And
I think that's
a
way to do it too. I would not want to go over there and try and find my way around. I would love to go with somebody who's been there.
Yeah,
I think that's the way to go.
Well, and he has the tour guide. I mean, he has actual tour guides who are there too. So mm-hmm. he's not, you're not just saying, oh, and what do you know, person from our church?
Sure.
Not that
yeah.
he probably doesn't, you know, he probably knows a lot already. But yeah, so you're going with people from your church or, you know, a Catholic church or something. Yes. And he started trying to get me to go mm-hmm. recently. And I was like, mm-hmm. well, first of all, I'd have to have a lot more money than I have. And I don't yeah. really care. But yeah, you know, I'll think about it.
Right,
if that
right.
money drops into my lap, I'll know what it's for. But it hasn't dropped yet, so.
Yep, gotcha.
I have other things to spend money on.
Mm-hmm, without question.
Kids in L.A., things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, and so. Good luck in L.A.
Yeah, good luck to Rose.
That's right.
We just got back, so.
Yeah.
I loved it, by the way.
Oh, good.
I didn't hate L.A., I loved it.
Great. So good. I'm looking forward to reading some more about that.
Yep. Got it on the blog.
All right. Well, okay. Well, next we're going to watch Lars and the Real Girl.
Yeah.
Which I have never seen, so I'm excited to see it.
Oh, well, what a treat. Mm-hmm. Of course, I would say that. I chose it.
You bet.
It will definitely shift gears from the magical world.
Yes.
To cool. the real world. More. It's kind of not a real world. I don't know. We'll see.
I'm assuming from the title, if there's a real girl, is there a not real girl?
Yes.
I guess we'll find out.
What you'll learn from the back of the movie is that mm-hmm. it's about a man and his blow-up doll, which is not really what you'd expect me to pick, but I'm telling you, it's great. Just trust me on
Fantastic.
This.
Fantastic. All right.
Watch it so you can hear us talk about it next time.
Good deal.
You've chosen a book.
Oh, yeah.
The
Life Cycle of Software Objects by Ted Chiang.
Yes.
Really looking forward to talking about that. Yep.
Yep.
Good stuff.
You can't beat Ted Chiang.
No, we can't. And I'm on the hook for the movie for the next one, or the one after that. So we'll get that picked.
We've got a month laid out ahead of us. That's good.
You bet. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah.
And
it was a great comeback after the break.
And you bet. And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, bye everyone.
Bye-bye.